Mine's right, obviously. But we're going to continue looking at the Gospel of Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount tonight from Matthew chapter 5. We're going to try to cover quite a lot of ground. And so here's what I did, and you don't have to like it. What we're going to do, there's a lot of material to discuss in this section, and I've been trying to conduct this as a discussion-oriented class. But if we discuss everything we want to discuss in this section, we'll cover 5 or 6 verses. So what I've done is I've picked out 2 or 3 things that I thought we had time to discuss, and I'll point those out, and we'll have discussions about those. And a couple of the others we're just going to have to hurriedly rush through, and I'll make a rationale best I can for why we're doing it. But it's the only way I know how to cover this section of Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 37. In fact, ordinarily when I preach this, I do all the way through verse 48 because it's all connected. This time I'm going to go ahead and break it into 2 chunks so at least we can spend a little more time on it, but not as much as we might like on every particular passage. So let me start in verse 17 through 20. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. There's a couple of translation issues in these verses, so I am going to ask a little bit. Jesus in verse 7 says, do not think that I have come to, ESV has abolish. What else do we have there? Anybody have something other than abolish?
Destroy.
Verse 17, do not think that I have come to, destroy is the only other word we got. Okay. So this, translators try to use a different word from what they use in Colossians or Ephesians when Paul talks about the law. I think, and this is just working off my memory here, I think the King James maybe has abolish in those passages, and so as not to look like a contradiction, it has destroy here. I didn't come to destroy it, but something might be abolished. The ESV has abolish here, and then uses cancel. The debt against you according to the law has been canceled, but the law has not been abolished. So what the translators try to do is give you that there's 2 senses, whatever those words may be, and trying to find the right English word is a little bit sticky. There is some sense in which the law is not going anywhere, and Jesus has no intention of it going anywhere, and that's what happened. How do I know? Because it's still in my Bible, right? But that's still God's intention, that we retain the law, that we make use of the law, and he'll discuss that in a second. But there is some other sense in which our relationship to the law has changed. Okay, so we don't make the sacrifices, we don't keep various parts of Levitical law, we don't do actually quite a lot of it, and for good reason. So Paul, now here again I'm going to get on to you, Paul has something to say. We're going to let Paul be Paul, and we'll cover that when we get to Paul. Tonight we're talking about Matthew and what Jesus says. And so Jesus' point is what he's not going to do, which is just to get rid of the law. His goal is not even replacement. I don't think that's a good word. Sometimes I hear preachers say that he replaced the law with the new law. But when you replace something, if I replace my sofa, I get rid of the old one. But I've still got the old one, right? It's right here. So it's still there, but our relationship to it has fundamentally changed. And the rest of this chapter kind of plays out what that means. Another thing he says is that the law, this is in verse 19, in the ESV it says, whoever relaxes one of these commandments, what do we have besides relax?
Breaks.
Sorry? Annul. Okay. This is another term, and you just, it's difficult to figure out which legal sense of this word did he have in mind. Break sounds like a violation of the law, whereas the way the the ESV has it is more like, well, we kind of relax, we're breaking it. We're just going to kind of make some loopholes into it. Okay. I kind of like what the ESV does with it because of the context. I don't know if I can make a word argument that that's a better word. But because of what he discusses next, the problem with what the people had done with the law is they had approached it looking for loopholes. They had come to it, God had said something with an intent, and they had come to it and read only the bare minimum out of it and built loopholes you could drive a truck through into the rest of it. So Jesus says, I'm not here to destroy it. In fact, I'm not even here to relax it. People who have been relaxing the law and creating these enormous loopholes, you have your own problem. I think that's kind of the sense of it. It is to be taught and fulfilled. In fact, more so than the teachers of your age were doing. The teachers of that time, the Pharisees and the scribes, were teaching the law, but Jesus says, not well. We're going to have to do better. So far from the idea that Jesus got rid of the Old Testament, his disciples would be keeping what God wanted out of the Old Testament more than the scribes and Pharisees were, is the point he seems to be making. But again, how to word that, I read a couple different renderings, but I'm really struggling with how to say that correctly in English. Because the words all change meaning every time you get a hold of one, so it's hard to know just exactly which one means to who. The good news is, that's a difficult paragraph, followed by about 30 verses of explanation, where Jesus is now going to say, well, what do I mean, fulfill the law? How do you fulfill a law? Let me do a word game with you. Match these words up. Fulfill a... What do you fulfill? A promise. You fulfill a... Duty. Fulfill a... Order, contract. If you were reading the Bible, you might think of a person fulfilling a prophecy. Okay? Fulfill an obligation. So those are the way you usually do it. How do you fulfill a law? You see, that's not the word that usually goes. Usually you obey a law. You fulfill a whatever. So he's treating the law differently here than people normally thought of it. He says it needs to be fulfilled and challenging the way we think about it. It wasn't just a legal code that you were supposed to find a way to dance around. It was a duty or a promise to be fulfilled. You had part of a covenant, the contract over here somewhere, you had part of a covenant to keep. And by finding ways around it and treating it like a law, and we need to find a way to get around it, you were evading your part of the covenant. So he says, no, we're going to keep covenant. And let me show you how. So here comes the application, and I'll just be candid. If the application didn't follow, I wouldn't know what to make of this. But he apparently knows that we were clueless and says, here is exactly what I mean. Let me give you some concrete examples of how what you're doing is bad and what I'm teaching is the fulfillment of the law. Matthew 5:21-26. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to the judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to the judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable to hellfire. So if you were offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. The first part, you kind of feel like you know what's going on, and then at the end of that paragraph kind of tails off and takes a turn, and it's hard to figure out where's he going, but I think there's a connection where we need to discuss it. So first of all, every one of these paragraphs and what follows starts out the same way. Either the law says, or sometimes he says, you've heard it said, which I think is his way of saying, I'm not sure if Moses ever actually said that, but your rabbis say it, so we'll go with that. You've heard it taught, you've heard the law say, in this case, you've heard it was said to those of old, And then it gives you some command or the way they had been taught the command out of the law of Moses. In this case, you shall not murder. That's pretty straightforward, right? And if you commit murder, you'll be liable to the judgment. And what he does is address what they had done with that law. Let me pause here. I'm going to come right back. Think about raising your kids a minute. What happens when you gave a rule to your kids? Well, they might break it. That's one thing. Another thing they might do, at least this is what my kids do. I don't know. Maybe it's a unique experience, but I think we all have it. They want to know if there is a way to get around it that doesn't technically break it. Okay? A friend of mine was telling me the story of his teenage son who he had sent to his room. He said, go run the vacuum in your room. And he went down to see the room, and quite literally the vacuum was plugged in, running, and he was sitting on the bed staring at the ceiling. Technically, he was running the vacuum in his room. Okay? What was he doing there? He took a law, a command, and he was trying to find a way around it that didn't specifically break what was said. This is what children do with rules. You say don't cross that line. Well, what if I could stand exactly on it? And depending on what age the kids are, sometimes they do it out loud. I mean, you can hear them thinking this. Lucas is a good kid, but this is what he'll do. I mean, he'll ask, yeah, but what if I, and that's usually where I cut him off, and I say, any question that starts with what if I, I'm betting I don't want to answer. Because it usually involves you, not Lucas my son, but Lucas the lawyer, who is trying to find a way around what I just said. Okay? Yeah, but what if? I told him, come back and fight. You can go outside and play, but we're going to eat dinner in about 10 minutes, so come back in 10 minutes. What if it's like 10 seconds past 10 minutes? He asked me that, right? So what is he doing? He's trying to know, what are the actual bounds of this command? How can I get around it? Okay, now back to our text. What do we do when we read a law from God? When you treat it like a law, then your brain naturally starts trying to find ways around it. God says, don't murder. Think of all the things you can do short of killing somebody. Right? What if I just beat him half to death? Well, that's not murder. What if I take his money and leave him penniless? Well, that's not murder. What if I insult him and shame him in front of everybody I know and degrade him in the community? Well, that's not murder. So clearly God's okay with me doing that, because what he said was, don't murder. And before you say, well, that's silly, that's exactly how we think all the time. It's how we read traffic laws. It's how we do the tax code. It's how you treat a law. It's like it's hardwired into our head. Somebody gives you a law and you immediately start working out ways to get around it without technically breaking it. And that's how they treated the law not to murder. Now, that might be the way to obey a law. It is not the way to fulfill a covenant. It's not the way to fulfill a duty with God. You don't need God to spell out in detail every possible way to violate it. You take what is said and you say, this is my part of the covenant, and you take it to heart and you try to take it seriously. So what does Jesus say? But I say to you, which by the way is a big deal, I'll just pause there for just a moment. Can you imagine on a Sunday morning if I got up and said, the Bible says this, but I say... That'd be a great last sermon, wouldn't it? That'd be the end of that. Ben got up and said, I know the Bible says this, but my personal feeling is that's bad news. Sorry? Be a great half sermon. You don't think I'd get through it, do you? Yeah. It'd be the end, whatever portion of it was. Yeah, because that's crazy talk, right? That's exactly what Jesus just said. You've heard it taught. You've heard it said of old. And he quotes Moses and says, but I say to you. For anybody but Jesus, that would be blasphemy on a large scale. Okay? And they notice this. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 7, the very last two verses, the crowd says, we've never heard one teach like this before, having his own authority. who got up and claimed to be able to instruct you more clearly than Moses or any of the teachers of the law after Moses. So just as a side note, this is a really big claim. Sounds subtle, but it's huge when he says, I know that Moses said this, but here's what I'm going to tell you. This is what God wanted out of you. Okay, so what does he say? Everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. And then he gives the list, insults his brother, calls him a fool. The word fool there is from a term, it's not particularly nice, raka or something like that in Aramaic. It's unpleasant. So he says, when you degrade someone like that, you are not keeping your end of the law, your end of the covenant. So what Jesus seems to be saying is, you heard the law and you started looking for permission. It says, don't murder so I can do anything else. But Jesus says, if you want to fulfill your part of the covenant, of the law, then you do that by including hatred, wrath, and evil speech, which was clearly the intent of the command not to murder. God said, don't murder, but what you were supposed to learn from that was, God does not want you to harm your neighbor. Not, God's okay with anything short of murder. See the difference? And that's what he emphasizes there. And then to go a step further, he doesn't even stop there. He says that the law not to murder was supposed to teach you to do something else, and that is to reconcile. So he gives some instructions about reconciliation. If you go to worship, and how does that word in? Your brother has something against you. Isn't that interesting? Because that's not the way we word it. We say, if you've got something against me, that's your problem. Jesus says, if your brother has something against you, you lay down your gift at the altar and you go and reconcile to your brother. And then he has courtroom advice. You don't want to get caught up in litigation, which in the ancient world probably more involved going to the local council, the town elders or whoever, and having them settle a dispute. Or possibly, if it's Romans, going to a Roman magistrate who could issue legal edicts and say, here's what you'll do. And his point is that that doesn't ever work well. You go to a court because you want the worst possible scenario to come about. You want punishment and vengeance, and you want justice meted out. He says, that doesn't work out for anybody. That's not a good behavior or attitude. Our goal is not to make sure that everyone gets what's coming to them. Our goal is to reconcile with other people. Now, that's miles apart from don't murder, or don't murder and I can do everything else. But Jesus says that's what it means to fulfill the law. So 5 minutes of discussion here. What do you see in the connection there between murder and reconciliation? Do you see where he connected those and what he's trying to teach about the law? Or do you have comments about that section there? It's about the attitude towards other people. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. The next one, another example, verse 27 and following. We'll go down through verse 30. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away, for it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away, for it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go to hell. So again, you've heard it said. So the same structure. And he's going to give them something they've heard. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, what had they taken that to mean, apparently? Probably the same thing. Well, talk about sexual ethics with a teenage boy. What does he immediately start doing? Yeah, but can I, right? Immediately, you start looking for the workaround. What am I allowed to do? How far can I get? What does this give me permission to do? And again, Jesus says, that's not the way you're supposed to read this. When it says don't commit adultery, it was supposed to teach you how to think about other people, even in your heart. So he says, if you look at a woman. I think the King James will say something like, who looks at a woman to lust. The ESV interprets that, I think interprets it correctly, and says that's looking to lust is to look with a lustful intent. So it's not just I happen to see something and it caught my eye, but rather when I am, what's a good English word, ogling? Or when I am leering, when I am looking with the intent of provoking my own lust, when I am intentionally provoking my own lust, he says it really doesn't matter that you didn't ever physically act on it. You missed the point of the law, which was to not view people in that way. To view yourself as having a covenant with your spouse or potential spouse if you weren't married, and to treat that as sacred rather than looking at other people as sexual objects to be desired. And that distinction, he says, is what you were supposed to get out of that. The adulterer looks at other people as potential sexual partners. The faithful person doesn't think of the world in that way, in theory. So instead, Jesus says, we don't look at others with a lustful intent. That's not how we treat other people. And then he says in verse 29 through 30, well, I want to stop there and ask a question. What does he say in verse 29 through 30? What's that about? What's his positive command, or if it is positive, what is his command that goes along with this in verse 29 and 30? I think that's the normal interpretation, and I can live with that. What he says, very literally, is start hacking off body parts, and that doesn't seem to be what we would normally think Jesus would say. So I think the way to read it is that you have to take control of your desires rather than let your desires control you. To the degree, in this kind of hyperbole, you know, of cutting off limbs, I don't think Jesus is suggesting you have an evil left hand or left foot and clearly you should whack it off and that would fix everything. But rather, if that would solve the problem, if taking control of that would do it, it would still be better than letting your desires run amok. So I wouldn't read 29 and 30 very literally by any stretch, but I would take it as a discussion of what Rosalie stated of taking control of your desires rather than your desires taking control of you. You have to master them, not the other way around. And as long as they're leading you, so sound familiar to our James teachers who are preparing for next quarter in James, because James has a lot to say about this. As long as your lusts are leading you, nothing but sin can possibly result, because lusts don't have restraints. They just keep going, looking for fulfillment. But a person has the ability to restrain, to rein in, and that would be far preferable to the consequence of lust. Lust, when it is conceived, brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. So Jesus says, cut it off. Be done with it. Does that kind of make sense in that passage, Jim? You think it's about the church, not the person's body, but the way the church acts together. Okay. I have never heard that interpretation before. Doesn't mean it's wrong. That's interesting. I'll have to think about that. I'm not thinking about it right now because I don't know what to think about it, but that's interesting. It's the church. I'm inclined to lean towards it being a reference to the person's body because he's talking about desires. But he does talk about what to do with other people here, so that might could work. I'll think about that, Jim. Or I could just go with your initial statement. What I've always read into that, see, that just means you made it up, right? So I'm just kidding. Any other thoughts on 29 and 30? The way Paul will say it is, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. That is, put to death the desires that are leading you in a bad direction. Okay, 31 through 32, this is one where we're not going to have a lot of discussion, simply because I have never had a discussion about divorce that took less than 30 minutes, and I've got five. So I'm just going to say a few words about it. And really, this is not the passage to discuss divorce in. It is a reference to it. The passage, if you want to have a lengthier discussion, you really want to read Matthew 19, verses 1 through 9, which is the lengthier discussion. This is a little bit compressed. I think it's the same thing he says in Matthew 19, but he says it in two verses instead of nine. So you almost have to skip a bit, don't you, to say nine verses in two. So I think we're going to go through Matthew this year, and we may get to chapter 19. And if we do, I'll promise that we'll try to spend more time discussing it there. But here it's a compressed statement with the same theme. And I think we can get the theme without the details. What did the law command? If you want to go read it this afternoon, it's a strange passage he's quoting. He seems to be quoting Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And what does Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 say? It says, if you find some kind of indecency in your wife, you may divorce her by giving her a writ of divorcement. And that's not all. 1 through 4 is a strange passage. If someone else marries her, and then if that man dies or he divorces her, verse 4 says, is it abomination for you to take the original wife back? Okay, so it's a fairly complicated passage about a... Here's the funny thing about... There's not a lot funny about divorce. I assume that law wouldn't be there unless someone had done that, right? This apparently had come up. Well, is it okay? What if that other guy dies? Can I go ahead? So they were having a discussion about that, and God gives a law about it. But what people took, again, to look at how people read laws, all they got out of it was verse 1. Oh, if I don't like my wife, I can divorce her as long as I write it down. And in the first century, we have evidence that that's what they were doing. Josephus talks about literally divorcing his wife because he found someone better looking. And he is a Jewish person who in theory is informed by Deuteronomy about how to live his life. He says, well, I found someone, the English translation says, I found someone handsomer than her, and so I put her away from me. Okay, and he felt totally justified because what he read out of Deuteronomy 24:1 was, well, I wrote it down. I gave her a writ of divorcement, and so it's okay. I found something indecent. We have rabbis from this era saying things like, if she doesn't cook well, that's indecent, isn't it? What could be more indecent than burnt toast? So if she doesn't cook well, that's indecent, put her out. And you have rabbis literally doing this and advocating that that was okay. So I think the point Jesus is making is, just like the law on murder and the law on adultery, you looked at that law and you looked hard for some kind of loophole to justify any kind of divorce you wanted. Any kind of anything. And he says, but what God had in mind was, if I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of sexual immorality makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So the indecency there had an intent. The goal when God says give her a writ of divorcement wasn't to encourage divorce. Okay, that was never God's... I mean, that's how backwards the reading had got. You got that especially in Matthew 19, which I said I wasn't going to talk about. But in Matthew 19, the question is, can we divorce for any cause? I mean, that's how broad the umbrella has gotten in Jesus' time and in our own. Yeah, anything we'll do. As long as you write it down. Do it legally. Give her a writ of divorcement. And Jesus says, that was never God's intent. Is there sometimes a cause for divorce? Jesus said, yes. And there's a specific one. What he calls here sexual immorality or fornication in the older translations. But it was never intended to be open license to divorce as you see fit. You did that to the law. That's not what God said. So in the same way that they misread the murder command and the adultery command to get what they wanted out of it, they had misread the divorce command to get what they wanted out of it. Okay. Definitely read Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And then scratch your head, because it is a head scratcher. 33, Okay, a couple minutes. Okay. 33 through 37 is the last one I want to cover, and I had some room for discussion on this one if we have a minute left. Again, you have heard it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but perform to the Lord what you have sworn. Now, see if you can stop there just for a moment. Can you guess what they might have done with that one? Are you getting the routine now of what they did when they read the law? Don't. Sorry? Jesus, in another passage, talks about the Corban thing, where you could swear by certain rules of the temple to dedicate your money to the temple, and then you didn't have to take care of your parents. That's an interesting example. I don't know if that's the one here, but that's a good that came to my mind too as one example of reading the law funny. What seems to be the case is they read this to mean, very literally, listen to it: you shall not swear falsely, but perform to the Lord what you have sworn. So if you swear to God or by God, then you keep it. But you know, there might be other things you could swear by that it might be okay to break those oaths. He didn't spell it out. And so they had kind of a system. He mentions this in another passage. What if we swear by the gold of the temple? He's going to say that in a few verses. What if we swear by the hair of my head? Which is a higher oath, and which one do I have to keep? And so they had kind of developed this very, the ethical term is casuistry, which is the practice of finding loopholes. It's a great word to learn. The practice of finding loopholes. They had interpreted this as just a system of loopholes. Keep to God all your oaths, but those other ones. So here's what Jesus says. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot take one or make one hair black or white. Yet what you shall say, let me try again, yet let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. So what they seem to have done is they seem to have a tiered system of oaths. All this sounds silly, but don't we? What's the first thing they do when you go into a courtroom to testify? Swear, or now you can swear or affirm, but used to, you swore in a Bible. Okay. Why do they do that? Because it's kind of understood. It's okay for you to lie the rest of the time. There are no legal consequences if you want to lie any other time. But if you're given an affidavit or a, what's the other word? Deposition, and you're under oath or you're testifying under oath, well, you got to keep that, but the rest of them, well, we don't know about you the rest of the time. We still kind of think that way. And you hear little kids do this too. Do you promise? Yeah. Do you swear? Yeah. Do you pinky swear? Okay. Pinky. Lenora was giving me, she's an old school teacher, she knows, pinky swear, that's how it works. That's the big one. That's like the temple right there. And so Jesus says, that's just not the way you're supposed to tell the truth. What would be a better solution? When God said, keep all your oaths, was he trying to tell you it was okay to lie the rest of the time? Or was he trying to tell you just to tell the truth? It seems to be that the simple answer was, just tell the truth, regardless, was the point. And stop looking for loopholes whereby you may lie. So the discussion, yeah, got a couple minutes. I wanted to have, what is then his instruction for us today? Is he prohibiting all oaths, some oaths, or the improper use of oaths? And if you give me an answer, you got to tell me why you think that.
I would pick three.
All three or number three? Okay, number three, improper use of oaths. How come?
He doesn't say don't swear by God. He says don't swear by heaven or earth, anything okay that God has made. And I think his point would be that if you're going to take an oath and you're going to swear it by God's name, you better realize what you're doing. Because okay, there's nothing higher or more sacred. Absolutely truthful about it.
Yeah.
And be willing to keep the
Okay. Other answers to that?
Doesn't the oath that you swear in court, doesn't it end, "So help me God"?
So help me God? That, again, it used to. I don't know if it does anymore. Now it's, "I swear a form by a God I do or do not believe in that I might or may not tell." That, I don't know. It's pretty vague now. But yeah, it used to. You swore in the Bible, "So help me God." And that's what we asked our politicians to do too, right? Put a hand in a Bible. We still do that one. Put a hand in a Bible and say, "So help me God." Yeah. So Jerry's distinction, which I think is fair, is that don't swear by things here below, but maybe still swear by God. Okay. The end of it, verse 37, points towards having simplicity in speech. So let me say, I don't know that Jesus has an opinion on what you do in a courtroom. If they want you, if it makes the judge feel better for you to swear on a stack of Bibles, then swear on a stack of Bibles. But a Christian should not require anything to be a person of his word. That it should be sufficient. The judge may not know it, but it should be sufficient for you. When you say yes, you mean yes. When you say no, you mean no. And he says anything else comes to evil. If you need additional words in order to make sure you tell the truth, then you're not a very honest person. So if I go in the courtroom, I'll swear the oath, but I'm not doing it to make me tell the truth. I'm doing it because it makes the court guy feel better. But I hope I'm the kind of person that when I say yes, you don't need to ask, "Yeah, but do you promise? Do you swear? Do you pinky swear?" We need to be the kind of people that when we say yes, we mean yes, and when we say no, we mean no. Anything else, if we need any other words to kind of cajole us into telling the truth, then there's something wrong with our character, and we're just looking for a way around the law. And that seems to be the point of emphasis, at least in verse 37. And I could let you make comments, but we're out of time. So next week, if you have some more comments, by all means, bring them, and we'll discuss them. Or I'll move on, one or the other. Thanks for your attention.